This is podcast number 142 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today we're spending New Year's Eve in Canada. As we continue with our study of the American Revolution in month 5, I want to share a story that bridges into our study of Canada, which is also one of our topics for this month. The event happened to fall on New Year's Eve, 1775. Our hero of the story, Richard Montgomery, is just 37 years old. After serving in the British military, he acquired some land just north of New York City, married the love of his life, and settled down to the quiet life of a farmer. He and his wife were living in a small cottage while he was building them a larger home, a time when he said to his wife he was never so happy in all his life. When the call to serve his country, his new country, came to him, his self-sacrifice and bravery is the hallmark of these early patriots to whom we owe so much and whose stories we should never forget. This telling of his story is taken from a book I included in the Forgotten Classics Family Library in Volume 3 of the Freedom Series. A favorite aunt is telling the story of America to her eager nieces and nephews each night. Let's join them for tonight's story, The Canadian Expedition, Richard Montgomery. All aboard for Canada was Harry's salutation this evening. Albert had wheeled up the lounge toward Aunt Edith so that Stevie might lie comfortably and listen. Little Grace was curled up at the other end of the lounge with her kitten in her lap, for she had learned to sit quite still while the talk flowed over her young head. All aboard for Canada, repeated Aunt Edith. We can easily say that, Harry, beside this bright winter fire with our comfortable surroundings. Wait until I draw the picture of our brave revolutionary soldiers marching barefoot and half-clothed through Canadian snowdrifts, and we shall be able to measure the long distance between reading or talking about heroes and being heroes ourselves. General Schuyler and Montgomery were ordered to assemble their forces at a point on Lake Champlain. Here General Schuyler fell ill and was obliged to return home, leaving the expedition, its dangers and glories, to the youthful Montgomery. He was a man of great military experience for his years, full of gifts, graces, and accomplishments, one of the most admired and beloved of the revolutionary heroes. The order to take charge of the Canadian expedition reached him in his beautiful home on the banks of the Hudson, where, with his young wife, whom he tenderly loved, he had settled, hoping for quiet years of domestic happiness in a home adorned with every refinement. But Montgomery loved honor more than life, and liberty more than happiness. He obeyed the call of his country. Albert, take your map and show the children the Sorel River, which joins Lake Champlain and the River St. Lawrence. Do you see any forts named there? Yes, Auntie, said Nanny, Fort St. John and Fort Chambly. Since the Americans had taken Forts Ticonderoga and Crown Point, the English had much strengthened these forts, especially St. John, as they were the only remaining defenses of Canada on that line. It was necessary to take it by siege. As soon as Montgomery's little band, not more than 1,000 in number, were armed and equipped, their gallant commander led them on until they came near Fort St. John, when they proceeded to invest it. "What does that mean, Auntie?" asked little Alice. "Albert, will you tell us how it is done?" "Sometimes by taking positions on hills or eminences outside the fort and mounting cannon to bear on it, sometimes by digging trenches until approaches are made near enough to make a final assault." "Yes, that's it. This fort was well armed and garrisoned, and its capture was a work of time." Hearing that Fort St. John was thus closely besieged, the British General Carleton came with a large force, intending to engage Montgomery in battle outside and thus relieve the fort, or, as military men call it, raise the siege. But Montgomery was ready to receive him. Carleton suffered a defeat and retreated with great loss. Montgomery proceeded with the siege. Fort Chambly being feebly garrisoned, he had dispatched a small number who surprised and captured it. This afforded him a further supply of cannon and ammunition. The provisions of the garrison of St. John were now nearly exhausted. Montgomery's trenches were near enough for the assault. He therefore sent a summons to the commander to surrender and thus save further bloodshed, informing him also of Carleton's defeat. Seeing no hope of succor from any quarter, he accepted Montgomery's terms and surrendered the post. The colors taken from the English were presented to Congress. Leaving a garrison to hold the fort, Montgomery hastened on toward Montreal. So rapid were his movements, and so well planned his attack, that General Carleton, after a slight resistance, fled in disguise to Quebec. The city capitulated, and many vessels and naval stores fell to the victors. Montgomery's object was to make friends of the Canadians and induce them to join the cause of the colonies. Though they did not do this, yet they received the Americans kindly and supplied them and their army with all that they needed. The news of this brilliant train of victory spread over the land. Montgomery's praises were on every tongue, and Congress voted him the thanks of the nation. But the young soldier's heart was sad. After leaving garrisons at Chambly, St. John, and Montreal, he found himself with only 300 effective men left him to attempt the capture of Quebec, which was, by natural position and military art, the most strongly fortified city in America. A Canadian winter was upon them, and their perils and hardships had but just commenced. Sad presentiments chilled Montgomery's heart. He often thought of his peaceful home in the bosom of the hills, the loving wife sitting in her loneliness there. He would have bartered all the glory he had won for 1 hour at that hearthstone. Should he ever see it again? Washington had foreseen the situation in which Montgomery would find himself, and, knowing that without the capture of Quebec, the expedition, the object of which was the conquest of Canada, would be a failure, had dispatched a column from his own camp near Boston to penetrate the state of Maine and come out into Canada at Quebec. He even hoped that they would reach it in time to surprise and take it while Montgomery was operating against Montreal. If not, they were to await his coming and operate with him. This force consisted of 10 companies of New England infantry, 1 of Virginia riflemen under the brave Morgan, and 2 companies of Pennsylvanians. In all the records of ancient or modern valor I have read, nothing equal to this wrestle of heroism and endurance with toil and suffering. Let us follow these noble soldiers on the map. They were to sail up the Kennebec River as far as navigable. Then they were to take flatboats, which Washington had ordered to be constructed for their use. Thence up the Dead River, a branch of the Kennebec. After that, their path lay through an uninhabited wilderness until they came to the sources of the Canadian River, called the Chaudière, which empties itself into the St. Lawrence River quite near Quebec. "It looks tolerably easy by the map," said Albert. "Yes, by the map, but as they advanced up the Kennebec, the stream became rapid and violent over its rocky bed. Often they could not row, but had to drag their heavily laden boats up the swift current, waist deep. It was winter, remember. The mountains were covered with snow, and the waters at a deadly chill. Beds of rock, falls, and rapids often forbade the passage of their boats at all. They had to be unloaded, arms, ammunition, baggage, and provisions, and the boats themselves carried by the men through tiresome, pathless forests until the stream would bear their boats again. Leaving the Kennebec, they dragged everything over a rough mountain ridge and through swamps and bogs, sinking knee-deep to the Dead River. Their course now lay up this river for 83 miles, and no less than 17 times, because of falls and rapids, they were forced to unload their boats and carry them, as I have before described. Winter winds howled around them. Their shoes were gone. Briars and rocks had torn their clothes from their backs. Storms drenched them. They had no shelter at night except what they made with the boughs of trees. Their provisions were nearly gone. Famine and death marched with them until they were forced to kill their faithful dogs that had followed their master's steps into the wilderness. But the love of liberty and their country kept its flame alive on the altar of their hearts, and they toiled on. They had dragged their boats 180 miles of the journey. They had carried them on their shoulders with all their contents 40 miles through frightful thickets, ragged mountains, and knee-deep bogs, till at last they reached the Chaudière, which goes foaming down its rocky bed at too rapid a speed, for it whirled over 3 of their boats, and they lost much of the stores and ammunition which they had brought so far with so much labor. They were now nearing their journey's end, and the first French Canadians who saw them wondered if they had fallen from the clouds. Arnold had sent forward several letters to Montgomery by the hands of friendly Indians to apprise him of his coming. Unfortunately, these letters were intercepted. "Oh, don't tell us that," said Harry, with the world of vexation on his face. Yes, but for this it was very possible that Arnold's brave heroes, worn and tattered as they were, coming suddenly upon the garrison, might have surprised and carried the defenses of the city. But the British strengthened their works and stood well upon their guard. Arnold bravely offered them battle outside the fort, but they did not accept it, and he was forced to march away some miles and wait for Montgomery's arrival. It was a glad day when their eyes caught the first sight of the American colors borne by Montgomery's men. There was a joyful meeting of friends in that far-off winterland. Montgomery had brought them woolen clothing and boots. He also gave them words of cheer and encouragement for their almost superhuman achievements. Counting their little band, those who remained to Montgomery after battle, siege, and assault, and those who remained to Arnold from the perils of the wilderness, they amounted to a few less than 1,000, including 2 companies of Canadians. This handful of men appeared in midwinter before Quebec, defended by 200 pieces of cannon and a garrison of twice their number, well provisioned. Montgomery spoke hopefully to his men, but in his heart he carried a weight of despair. To return without taking Quebec was to throw away all the brave work he had done. Congress expected it. The nation waited for it. A soldier's fame is dear to him as life. To a patriot, the cause of his country is above all else. No time was to be lost. The rigors of winter were becoming intolerable, and the sufferings of the men were beyond endurance. 2 diseases attacked the camp, smallpox and homesickness. "Poor fellow," said Nanny, the tears standing in her eyes. "Dear Auntie, what did put it into their heads to go in the winter?" "Sure enough," added Albert, "you said Washington never made mistakes, but that seemed very much like one." "They did not choose the winter, but they accepted it as a necessity. England had no army in Canada at this time. In the spring she would have. It was now or never for the capture of Canada. Moreover, Congress ordered the Canadian expedition. Being ordered, Washington contributed to the best of his ability to its success. Montgomery and Arnold used every honorable provocation to induce General Carleton to come out of his defenses and fight. They would then have had a fair chance of success, but the British general thought prudence the better part of valor. Finding all his efforts unavailing, Montgomery said, "To the storming we must come at last." The year was growing old, but a few days remaining of 1775, the term of enlistment of most of the men expired with it. The generals planned for a night assault. The night of the 26th of December was clear and so cold that no man could handle his arms or scale a wall. The 27th was hazy, and the troops were put in motion, but the sky cleared, and Montgomery, tender of their lives, called them back and waited for a night of clouds and darkness, with a storm of wind and snow. On the 30th, the New Year's Eve, a northeast snowstorm set in. The troops were divided for attack at different points, Montgomery reserving the post of danger for himself. 2 of the attacks were to be mere pretenses, to draw attention from the real points, which were to be assaulted by Arnold on one side and Montgomery on the other. The snow had changed to driving hail that cut the men's eyes and faces. They advanced with heads down and their guns under their coats to keep them dry. A braver man than Arnold never led men to battle. They assailed their point of attack with the greatest fury. A musket ball in his leg disabled Arnold early in the action, and he was borne to the rear. Morgan took command, and cheering on his men with words of victory, they carried the battery and took its defenders prisoners, though with great loss of life. He held for a time the lower part of the town, and there they waited and watched for the promised signals from Montgomery's side. He, with 300 men, and his two aides, McPherson and Cheeseman, two gallant young soldiers, took their course along a steep and rocky path, made so slippery and dangerous by the frozen snow and hail that it was a constant effort to keep their feet. On they went, Montgomery opening the path through the snow with his own hands. A battery intercepted their path. It must be taken. Montgomery ordered them to double quick, himself leading with the words, "Come on, brave boys, you will not fear to follow where your general leads." A flash, a well-served cannon discharge. Montgomery, McPherson, and Cheeseman fall dead. The drifted snow was the winding sheet of the beautiful and brave on the morning of the new year, 1776, before the gates of Quebec. Seeing their leaders fall, the men had no courage to advance over their dead bodies. They retreated. Morgan and his men waited on the other side of the town for the signals, which, alas, they should never see. They waited too long. The enemy, released from defending other points, surrounded and took them prisoners. To General Carleton's praise be it spoken, the bodies of the noble fallen received burial with all the honors of war. Montgomery had fought under England's banner in his youth and had even then won a name for honor and valor. When the news of his death reached England, the great defenders of liberty in the British Parliament vied with each other in his praise and wept as they pronounced his eulogy. Washington bewailed his loss, for he loved him as a brother. All over the land, men wept as for a heart friend. Congress, desiring to transmit to future ages an example of patriotism, boldness of enterprise, and contempt of danger and death, reared a monument of marble to the glory of Richard Montgomery. But the bitterest tears were shed in that pleasant home amid the hills of Hudson. A grief was there for which earth had no balm, for Montgomery's wife took no other love in his stead. Years after the toils of war had passed, Washington kept state in the city of New York as first president of the republic for which Montgomery had died and for which Washington had lived. It is related that on reception days, it was the custom for the secretaries and gentlemen of the household to hand ladies to and from their carriages. But when the honored widow of Montgomery came, the president himself performed these complimentary duties. The little group sat silent for a moment, and Albert said, "I can't help thinking, Auntie, that it was a great mistake for them to undertake this expedition." "If we consider it as a piece of offensive warfare, perhaps it was, though the cause of failure seemed to be the accident of Montgomery's death at the critical moment. For it was afterward found that the battery was served only by a handful of men, and if Montgomery had not fallen, its capture would have been an easy matter. He, without whom the sparrow does not fall, gave the final orders. We rough-hew our destinies, but he shapes them as he will. It would doubtless have been better if they had stood upon their defense, instead of entering a neutral province, and had contented themselves with putting strong garrisons into the forts on the lakes, on our own territory, thus keeping the doors into Canada well locked on this side. No success attended them afterward, though Congress, against Washington's advice, continued their efforts to accomplish their designs there. War is a horrible wickedness, and includes every form of suffering and wrong. It is unmitigated barbarism from beginning to end, except in defense of a just cause. In that case, we are commanded to resist unto blood, and every man who lays down his life fairly earns the name of martyr. Montgomery gave his life to win for us those civil and religious liberties which have made our country the glory of all lands. The hero keeps his quiet, unbroken slumber in the graveyard of St. Paul's Church, New York, just a step aside from Broadway. Of all the busy, toiling, hurrying millions that yearly pass and repass above the sacred dust, how many pause to lay upon his grave the chaplet of a grateful memory? Bye-bye. See you next time.